anything special, but let me look in my YouTube. And it says, this, whistleblowers
who actually came forward and pointed out to the fact that Ayatollah Khomeini, while in France for over a decade, he had communication with the United States, with the United Kingdom, with the CIA.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, coming to you on the 17th of June, 2016. And if you have been following the headlines, especially the headlines at CorbettReport.com, you'll note that there have been some new blockbuster documents recently declassified pertaining to the 1979 so-called Islamic Revolution in Iran. And the headline that I went with, another conspiracy confirmed, Khomeini had a secret channel with the U.S.
So, I have a tweet from Sybil missing from Hillary's or Hillary Clinton's emails. Saudis work with CIA to create terror. Hillary Clinton's email to her current campaign manager, John Podesta, dated August 17, 2014, implicates Qatar and Saudi Arabia as the main logistical and financial supporters of the Islamic State. In the email, Clinton recommended the United States use its diplomatic and more traditional intelligence assets to bring a pressure on the governments of Qatar and Saudi Arabia to put them in a position of balancing policy between their ongoing competition to dominate the Sunni world and the consequences of serious U.S. pressure. Unquote. Secretary of State Clinton's proposal appears to be a reaction to growing awareness of the role of Gulf monarchies have played in supporting and funding not only the Islamic State and al-Nusra, but a constellation of jihadi groups in the Middle East. Left unmentioned by Clinton is the fact the United States, under a number of administrations, has worked closely with Gulf monarchies to spread Sunni Wahhabism across the Muslim world. Financial elite in the West played a direct role in the spread of Wahhabism. In 76, Saudi Prince Mohammed al-Faisal established the Faisal Islamic Bank of Egypt, FIBE. Several of founding members were leading members of the Muslim Brotherhood, including blind Sheikh Oman Abdul Rahman, implicated in the first World Trade Center bombing in February 93. Muslim Brotherhood became an MI6 and later CIA asset during the covert war and assassination plot against the nationalist pan-Arab leaders in Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser. FIBE and the rise of Islamic banking following the dramatic increase in oil prices in 73 are closely associated with neoliberal financial policies and the philosophy of the Chicago School of Economics and the monetary prescriptions of the International Monetary Fund. FIBE worked closely with the infamous Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, a renegade bank used to fund covert terrorist activity and launder money, sell illegal weapons, and facilitate the international drug trade. After BCCI crashed and burned in 91, investigators discovered it held $589 million in unrecorded deposits, $245 million of which were placed with FIBE. BCCI consisted of a complex alliance of intelligence agencies, multinational corporations, weapons dealers, drug traffickers, terrorists, global bankers, and high-ranking government officials, writes David DeGraw. The Muslim Brotherhood also established the Al-Taqwa, TAQWA, bank in 1988. It funded radical Wahhabi groups including Al-Qaeda. Bank was associated with the late Saeed Ramadan, one of the Muslim Brotherhood's top leader. Ramadan was the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, founder of Muslim Brotherhood. He also helped the Saudi monarchy establish the Muslim World League in 1962. Organization would later fund Al-Qaeda and numerous other terror groups. Declassified Swiss documents from the 60s reveal Ramadan was an asset of the CIA and British intelligence. It's no exaggeration to say that Ramadan is the ideological grandfather of Osama bin Laden, but Ramadan, the Muslim Brotherhood, and their Islamist allies might never have been able to plant the seeds that sprouted into al-Qaeda had they not been treated as U.S. allies during the Cold War and had they not received both overt and covert support from Washington, writes investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus. In addition to funding radical Islamic groups, the Saudis helped establish a so-called Safari Club in 76. Chief instigator of the group was Alexander de Marenches, M-A-R-E-N-C-H-E-S, head of the French External Intelligence Service, S-D-E-C-E. Like the BCCI, and the Safari Club funded off-the-books terror operations and worked closely with al-Mukhabarat, al-Amma, M-U-K-H-A-B-A-R-A-T, al-Amma. The Saudi intelligence organization, Kamal Adham, and then his nephew, Prince Turki. Adham acted as a channel between Henry Kissinger and Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, and former member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Oh, I didn't know Anwar was. Safari Club was run by Saudi arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi of Iran-Contra fame. He also had connections to the BCCI. According to author Joe Trento, Safari Club preferred working with a rogue faction of the CIA made up of agents close to ex-CIA director George Bush Sr. and decorated CIA officer Theodore Shackley. The private shadowy spy organization within the CIA, according to Trento, was organized during an effort by the Carter administration to reform the agency following revelations of the Church Committee in the mid-70s. See Peter Dale Scott's The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America. And there's our links to those from Newsbud, which 2016-10-24, missing from Hillary Clinton's email, Saudis work with CIA to create terror. That I'm reading from, Bush cemented strong relations with the intelligence services of both Saudi Arabia and the Shah of Iran. He worked closely with Kamal Adham, A-D-H-A-M, head of Saudi intelligence, brother-in-law of King Faisal, and an early BCCI insider, Scott writes. During May 79 meeting of globalist Bilderberg Group, the British historian Bernard Lewis presented a British-American strategy which endorsed the radical Muslim Brotherhood's movement behind the Iran's Khomeini in order to promote Balkanization of the entire Muslim Near East along tribal and religious lines. Lewis argued that the West should encourage autonomous groups such as the Kurds, Armenians, Lebanese, Maronites, Ethiopian, Copts, Azerbaijani, Turks, and so forth. The chaos would spread in what he termed an arc of crisis, which would spill over into the Muslim regions of the Soviet Union. See F. William Engdahl's A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, London, Pluto Press, 2004, page 172. The previous year, CIA began training Islamic militants in Pakistan as part of an effort to destabilize neighboring Afghanistan and draw in the Soviet Union. Robert Gates, who would become a CIA director and later Secretary of Defense under Obama, recalled a meeting held on March 30, 1979, where Undersecretary of Defense Walter Slocum proposed sucking the Soviets into a Vietnamese quagmire, unquote. President Carter formally approved covert aid to the CIA, supported Afghan Mujahideen in July. See Robert Gates from the Shadows, Ultimate Insider Story of Five Presidents and How They Won the Cold War, New York, Simon & Schuster, 2007, page 145. Oh, yeah, so in 1985, I think it was, DJ Mouse got a letter from Norman Shumway saying even the president couldn't stop the execution of Namiri by the Muslim Brotherhood, of Muhammad Mohammed Taha on the upcoming Friday, before refusing to adopt the state religion of the Islamic Brotherhood. Now, in 1973, I got 50 miles a gallon because of the Arab oil embargo. I had put a fiberglass 3.5 feet high, 1,300 pound car together, Formula V, and 1,500 engine with pancake high compression. High compression piston. So it got 50 miles to gallon going from Klamath Falls, about 30 miles past Rockland. And I could drive 45 because there was no one on the freeway. So you can get 50 miles a gallon pretty easy. Just drive 45. 40 pounds of air in the tires, high profile. That's what 1973 means. And that's why they said the UN resolution 1973, so everybody would know what's going on. The last to drop the oil embargo was Libya. And he had put our shit-stained Tim Osman, the CIA assassin, on the Interpol wanted list. CIA became the grand coordinator purchasing or arranging the manufacture of Soviet-style weapons from Egypt, China, Poland, Israel, and elsewhere, or supplying their own, arranging for military training by American, Egyptians, Chinese, and Iranians, hitting up Middle East countries for donations, notably Saudi Arabia, which gave many hundreds of millions in dollars in the aid each year, totaling probably more than $1 billion, pressuring and bribing Pakistan, with whom recent American relations had been very poor, to rent out its country as a military staging area and sanctuary, putting the Pakistani director of military operations, Brigadier Mian Mohammed Afzal, onto the CIA payroll to ensure Pakistani cooperation, writes Phil Gasper. According to Dreyfus, American alliance with Afghan Islamists long predated the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 79 and had its roots in CIA activity in Afghanistan in the 60s and in the early and mid-70s. And Israel Shamir details, because he was in the Israeli army in that 73 war, how Sadat is meeting with Golda Meir and Haig and all these guys who are setting this up. And then, in 67, they were sending the nukes towards Cairo. And Dead in the Water describes that, the attack on the Liberty, false flag, of course. The line between radical Islam in Afghanistan in the 80s and the Islamic State remains unbroken. There is direct correlation between al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI, and the Islamic State in Iraq that originated with Tanzim Qaidat al-Jihad fi Bilad al-Rafidiyan, a.k.a. al-Qaeda in Iraq. AQI was the subject of a Pentagon black op and propaganda campaign targeting the Iraqi resistance following Bush invasion in 2003. And that's my place. Make sure that was recording, but it was so. And can you hear that thing going off like it did last time? I don't know. Are we picking up bugs? Let me shut up. Anyway,
detailing how Ayatollah Khomeini, who was, of course, in exile in Paris at the time of the beginning of the 1979 revolution and the ouster of the Shah, was in fact already in contact with the great Satan, the U.S., and had opened a diplomatic channel of sorts with Jimmy Carter, in which he assured him that you will see we are not in any particular animosity with the Americans. And also that the oil flow will continue after the establishment of the Islamic Republic. Some very interesting statements. Although I imagine that in my audience, there are several people who will look at that type of headline and just roll their eyes and say, well, what else is new? But maybe this is more important than that. It does have bearing on some pretty important geopolitical issues. So in order to get perspective on this issue, we're going to turn to someone with first-hand experience of the Islamic so-called revolution of Iran in 1979. We're going to turn to Sibel Edmonds, of course, the founder and editor of BoilingFrogsPost.com and Newsbud.com. Sibel, congratulations! $150,000, the first goal of the Newsbud.com campaign, has been reached. thank you for putting this together and congratulations on the milestone.
Hello, James. Thank you. However, we have been warning everyone. We've been asking people not to prematurely congratulate us. I think it's exciting. We are so thankful to our supporters. However, people who are familiar with fundraisings like Kickstarter, etc., they know that last-minute glitches happen, you know, for one reason or another. Some people may realize that their credit card didn't have enough limit, or some people, for whatever reason, during the last few days of campaigns, you know, if like maybe some pseudo-election shows that they put in there, some unexpected things happen, and we have been told to hold off, not congratulate each other, not to get comfortable. In fact, ask our supporters to continue pledging, to continue putting the word out. We want to thank every single person, every single one of you who have supported us. And we want to say we are excited, we are enthusiastic, but it's not over yet. We have 4.5 days to go, and a lot of things can happen in 4.5 days. So please don't quit. Let's not get this false sense of security. Let's celebrate, and we're going to have a celebration party with all our team members. You're invited. We'll celebrate it online with all of you after Tuesday, June 21st. Let's keep at it for 4.5 more days. By the time this video comes out, 4 more days.
Excellent. Well, don't count your chickens before they hatch. Don't count your funds before
exactly.
They come in. The funds will actually come in on Tuesday. So if you haven't pledged yet, please do pledge to make sure that NewsBud is over that hurdle. The link will, of course, be in the show notes. So let's get into today's conversation, as I say, talking about the revolution in Iran in 1979 and this revelation, or at least the declassification of documents that have long been rumored to exist, showing a secret channel of communication between Khomeini and Carter before the revolution actually took place, or as it was going on. Perhaps you, as someone who actually lived through that experience, can set the scene and the context for this this information. Why is this important? What does it tell us that we didn't know before, didn't have documentary proof about before?
Absolutely. As always, you emphasize the importance of historical context, and we have to do that, especially in this case, because I was in Iran. My father was an activist. He participated in revolution in Iran. He actually took me with him to the marches, including the infamous Black Friday march. At the time, I was 9.5 years old. He was working in the university, and a lot of people within the academic environment, they became organizers of marches against the monarchy, against Shah's regime. None of them, that the ones I knew, none of them were Islamists. However, there is this misconception, this wrong assumption, thanks to the U.S. media, thanks to the U.S. academia, thanks to the United States and the Western propaganda, that this revolution was brought about by the Islamists, by the extremist religious fanatics. And then, boom, all of a sudden, overnight, they threw out, you know, the regime, Shah regime, and they established Islamic regime. That is absolutely false. That revolution, that discontent was brewing for many years. In fact, we have to go back to 1950s when Mossadegh nationalized oil and wanted to bring kind of a representative government in Iran, and he really, really garnered a lot of popular support. And so compared to what it was, Iran was moving towards democratization, you know, how we love to spread democracy. And in 1950s, that really set this very intense panic among United States and other Western nations, especially United Kingdom. And they were like, we can't have democracy in Iran. This guy is going to nationalize oil. We have been sucking like leeches, like parasites. This is not acceptable. So they said, nope, no democracy for you, like the soup Nazi in Seinfeld episode. And they basically brought about this coup, this coup d'etat in Iran. And they installed Shah. And of course, Israel and Zionists played a very, very, very important role. So I would say the three main players in this were the United States, United Kingdom, and the Zionist elements. So they said, we want Shah, we want monarchy. Shah came, he had this incredible coronation ceremonies. You know, he peed in diamond and gold toilet bowls, getting people's public's money. And of course, everything with oil was fine, the arrangement with the West. But the discontent and people's the unrest continued, and it kept building up. And there were several major movements in Iran. We had the atheists slash communists who were after a model like the Soviet Union. We had moderate socialists. You see many of these people, you saw them within the academic environments, you know. You had people who wanted to model after United States Constitution and have some sort of a representative system where the communists would be represented, multi-party system, and you had Islamists. And then you had these weirdos, I'm sorry, I have to call them weirdos, Mujahideen Khalq, MEK, and they were Islamic communists. I don't know how you can mix the two, but they were a segment too, so they were going to have their representative government. So all these different factions, after years of competing with each other, never getting anywhere, they decided to put their differences aside. They said, let's get united. And let's get rid of Shah. You know why? Because after all, the major goal, all of us have this common goal, get rid of monarchy, right? Once we get rid of the monarchy, then we'll settle our differences. You know, that's easier said than done. And we have talked about that before. It's like, sure, you can revolt, you can throw out, but what's going to happen the morning after? That's the question. Who wants to become the major power? You know, it becomes always this power struggle among factions. Well, these factions, they put their differences aside, and they got together. They had the marches, including that Black Friday march that my father took me to. They were students, they were communists, they were socialists. So they got rid of Shah. And then the question became, now who was going to have the upper hand? And this was when the Islamists, they had a little bit of majority. They went and they talked with those who were after representative governments and Mujahideen Khalq. And they said, you know what? Let's get together and get rid of the Communist Party because they are godless. You know, they are atheists. They have no place in Iran. And they nodded. They said, sure, we, three, four of us, factions, can set up representative government. Overnight, they rounded up thousands of people. They beheaded them. They basically shot them to death. They put them in jail. And then 6 months, 9 months later, two of the other, you know, Islamists got together with another faction. They said, let's get rid of these guys now, you know, the process of elimination. And then they gained a monopoly. And we had Ayatollah Khomeini coming there. And slowly, not overnight, we were first, women were asked to put loosely scarves. Then they said they have to cover all their hair. You know, that's systematic conditioning, one step at a time. You know, Department of Homeland Security, TSA pat down. Oh, the NSA thing comes out. And before you know, you are under this fascistic government. I know they are accusing Iran of that. I think we are basically the same boat, except we can have our hair exposed. So, I mean, that's such a, I know, valuable thing. Other than our hair being exposed, we are basically on the same boat, people. So that's the story of what took place in Iran. It was not, well, after the Islamic regime gained control, these documents that are being exposed now, the facts in these documents, they surfaced several times in Iran in 1981, in 1982. There were whistleblowers who actually came forward and pointed out to the fact that Ayatollah Khomeini, while in France for over a decade, he had communication with the United States, with United Kingdom, with the CIA. the fact that another famous Ayatollah Rafsanjani, who was in the United Kingdom in kind of an exile, he had millions and millions of dollars bank accounts in United Kingdom. His kids enjoyed going to the Western universities, and they are anti-Western, right? And they started putting out information. However, the regime basically started either eliminating them by accusing them of being foreign agents, spreading rumors, or the newspaper and people, basically the regime would point and say, these people are conspiracy theorists, you know? They are coming with all sorts of wild, crazy conspiracy. Aren't we calling United States the great Satan? And also another factor to keep in mind, James, is all the stuff with OPEC, that the OPEC crisis in 1970s, and when we discussed that movie, that came up about the fact how much was taking place. There were tons of things taking place in Libya, in Egypt, you know, with Israel becoming real, the Israel today, and of course the OPEC crisis. So that's the main macro, trying to quickly say what was the situation. Now, as we know, they passed this law, I believe it was during Clinton administration, and they put this time limit on the classified documents. They said, we're going to give, I don't know, 40 years. Is that the 40 years or 30 years time limit? And after that, all these things within CIA, et cetera, should be declassified, right? It sounds great, doesn't it? It sounds wonderful. And again, a lot of people like to accept these kinds of nice sounding notions at face value and say, yeah, transparency, sunshine. Well, first of all, you have to start thinking critically and say, first of all, you don't know how much is being classified, what is being classified. Think about a big chest and there are millions of documents, okay? And they are telling you that every 30 years or 40 years, they are declassifying these, and as the time passes, the expiration date comes, they put it out there. How can you establish that's happening? Number one, you don't know what's classified. Number two, you don't know how many pages are classified. Number three, there is no oversight. The ones who are declassifying are the people who have classified it. These are the agencies with tremendous amount of stakes there. For example, a good example of this would be Operation Gladio. It has been established as a fact that we've been carrying out Operation Gladio. It started in 1950s after World War II, and then it grew from there. As you know, James, nothing really has been declassified on Operation Gladio, and that passes the expiration date by another 40, 30 years. Now, same thing with this document. Now, they put out this information. They are saying this is now declassified. The question now for me is, why are they putting this information out? Because think about it. The question is, had they not declassified it because of the expiration stamp, which one of us would have known that there was some documents there, the expiration date passed, and they didn't declassify, right? We don't know what is in there. So that boils down to the question of why. Why the CIA, why the United States government, why the deep state is declassifying this incredibly important documents? And I don't have any reason to doubt its authenticity, because as I said, we knew that the relationship was there, the communication lines were open, and we knew that United States, the Western countries, they were in this position that if they did not join forces with one of the main elements in Iran, they had this risk of losing Iran to the Soviet Union. You know, they share borders, Caspian Sea, you know, the whole oil basin there. So if they had to take side, the Westerns, and if they had this major stakes, who would have they sided with? Well, obviously, they didn't fall into the Soviet camp, because you're looking at religious Islamists. And the Soviets didn't gain anything in this. So the question remains as well, it was beneficial to which two sides at the time during the bipolar world that we were living under? And then the question is, why are they declassifying this now? Because whoever decided to declassify this, the deep state, the powers, they know what this causes in Iran, okay? it may not be a big deal for a lot of people here in the United States. Oh, yes, they declassified, so somebody says this. But in Iran, as we speak, as we are recording this session, so much is going on with the age of internet, Twitter. Everybody in Iran knows that these mullahs, ayatollahs, who are calling the United States the great Satan, it was all for show. And it stinks, you know, they know that something is really awfully rotten in Iran. So that for me, because for the past few years, I've been saying Syria, Yemen is in Obama's watch, and the next administration is going to restart, rejuvenate that whole Iran issue within the domino, within the chessboard. Who else really is left that we haven't really gone inside? You know, Syria, Yemen, Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan. Well, it's Iran is the only one really left standing. And they strategically, I believe, kept that for the next administration. I mean, each administration gets two or three to juggle. And Obama had his hands full with his. And Iran is going to be for the next one. And the next one is coming, whether it's Trump, whether it's Hillary Clinton. And, this would go a long way to rekindle, rejuvenate that Arab Spring moment for the Iran Spring. You will see, every one of our viewers will see how this is going to come into play 6 months, 9 months down the road, a year down the road, with people revolting and showing that these people were not even who they said they were for the Islamic regime. And this is going to come up and resurface over and over again. And I want to quickly mention a quick piece of information. 14, 15 years ago, through one of the legal firms that I worked with during my case, I got to know this investigator, PI, private part-time investigator, the firm had hired. Now, this man used to work for the CIA. He was an agent, and he spent years in Iran during Shah's regime. And his cover, he told me, he introduced himself, said, yes. And he actually spoke Farsi, and I speak Farsi. I said, wow, how did you learn? He said, well, I lived in Iran. I worked for the State Department / the agency. And his cover was the radio announcer for the English language radio in Iran, broadcast from the embassy. That's one of the common covers there. And he said, you know, the hostage taking, that infamous scene that whenever they talk about Iran, U.S. mainstream media, guess what they always like to show? They like to show that, you know, these bearded men going there and taking over the U.S. embassy, and they're taking these poor Americans as hostage. Barbarics, you know, I think that is the most famous scene that has been played billions of times by the U.S. media. It's always pointed at by the U.S. media because of their masters wanting that scene being like this thing. You say Iran, the first thing people think, visualize is that hostage taking, those barbaric animals, you know. Well, he was there and he said 5-6 days before the hostage taking, we, State Department, CIA special staff members, were given a notice, cable, to immediately leave Iran and go to, and they gave us option, Greece, Turkey, Tunisia, etc. Have some vacation time, beach time, you know, and then don't come back to the United States until we got our next assignment for whatever country. So he said, I packed immediately. It was like immediate now. You're leaving Iran. All the embassy people who were connected to CIA, anybody high level, were given notice to immediately leave Iran 5 days before that hostage taking. So the only ones who were left there, they were some administrative people. None of them were really CIA. They got all the key staff and they got them out of the country. Okay. And they left those poor patsies there to suffer, the administrative people. So that hostage-taking incident would take place. Now, you and I would say, therefore, it was some sort of a pre-arranged incident. They got heads up that the regime and the rebels, using rebels, they were going to take over the embassy. They were given timelines so that they could take the important staff, see the real bad guys, CIA people, out of the country, okay? And then leave a few poor Americans in there to go through the staged event. So you are looking at false flag. You are looking at staged event. So that's another key fact that tells me the document they declassified is factual. The question that we must be asking is why? Why now? What are they planning? What's the next move on this chessboard? And I would say, mark my word, you're going to be coming back to it over and over during the Iran Spring. Iran Spring is coming, people.
Well, Sibel, I think you've hit on every single point that I wanted to cover, so I'm not sure there's much left for me to say, except for, first, let me back up a couple of things that you're saying. Of course, this is being portrayed in the Iranian media as conspiracy theory. This is ridiculous. These are fabricated documents, the exact types of things you would expect. For example, Iranian Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani came out and said those exact things. Oh, they're fabricated documents.
Sure.
Designed to manipulate public opinion. Well, I think it is designed to manipulate public opinions, but I don't think it's fabricated. But they also, in Iranian media, press TV, pointed to Gary Sick, who was part of Carter's national security team. And he described himself as the point man in the White House dealing with Iran. He wrote a blog post dismissing the recent BBC Persian service, or whatever they call themselves, reports revealing these documents for the first time as a tempest in a teapot. He said, pretty much what you said. He said, this is not new information. I've written about this. Others have written about it in greater context in the past. Here's a segment from my book where I talked about this decades ago. So this is basically backing up what you're saying. This is not exactly new information, but the documents themselves are at any rate new. And so the question is, why now? And I think you touched on that very well. Why now? It's to destabilize or to throw a spanner in the works in Iran and to try to delegitimize the ruling powers.
And one other important thing here to mention, because I know there are a lot of people, they say, because of his stand, and I appreciate that, Jimmy Carter's, when it comes to Israel and some of the comments he've made, but you know how people like to put people on pedestal and worship, and that same thing with Jimmy Carter, you know, compare relatively speaking, you know, was he much better than, let's say, Clinton? To a certain degree, he was, but same people, I would ask them to also remind themselves he gave one of the most important historical roles to that despicable jerk, Henry Kissinger. Because during this whole stuff, everything was designed and implemented by Henry Kissinger. All the Iran visits with Shah before the revolution, right before, when Shah was actually begging Kissinger and Carter administration to provide support. He knew he was falling, and they shook their head. They didn't. In fact, when Shah was on exile, he flew the country. He wanted to come to U.S. because that's where all his bank accounts were kept. And U.S. says, you can't land here. So his private planes kept going and getting refueled and trying to find a country for asylum and stay. So he was abandoned by his masters, the puppet masters who installed him. So you have to think about it and say, why would the U.S. do that? You know, with this, if it were so bad, they didn't rescue their boy. They said, we're going to hang you out there to dry. What they going to do with any of these they did that with Bhutto, you know. I mean, Bhutto went to United Kingdom, but that's what they did. But again, when people, they said Carter was the greatest and he's all the stuff and everything. All I want them to do is same Jimmy Carter had put this man in the top position in the United States government, Henry Kissinger.
Right.
The fox behind a lot of things that took place.
And
in
who was Carter's national security advisor? Zbigniew Brzezinski, the left counterpart of Kissinger, who, of course, was the co-founder with David Rockefeller of the Trilateral Commission, which put Carter on the map politically. So,
but, you know, if you and I mention these facts, the fact that Kissinger and Brzezinski, now suddenly we're going to be called, we are Zionist supporters because Carter has been tough on the Zionists and Israel. And by stating these facts, you and I become the shills, of course.
You never win against people who want to call you a shill for whatever reason. But, okay, so let's bring this back down to what I think should be our takeaway from this, and our, I mean, in the West, looking at this story, which is clearly a type of directed declassification that is aimed at manipulating public opinion in Iran. I think we can agree on that. But the question is, how should we view this, and in what context? And I think the intended effect is for us to go, oh, look at Khamenei. Oh, yes, of course, he was doing back-channel dealings and trying to wheel and deal to get into Iran. But really, the flip side of this is, well, the U.S., I mean, why was Khamenei in contact with America about what was going on in Iran? It's because everyone knew that the Americans really controlled the Iranian military at that time. And the whoever America supported was going to be able to affect the transition in power that was taking place, that was already taking place. So the real implication of this is, yes, America was in control of Iran in a really technical military sense at that time, and they used that influence to create what became the Islamic Revolution. So what is the implication? It's that America continues to have influence and continues to direct and influence events that go on there. And I think that's the way that the American audience and Western audience should be looking at this story, is that the flip side of this is the Americans were dealing with Khomeini. And it shows time and time again these things are manipulated from behind the scenes. Any final thoughts on this before we wrap up the conversation?
No, I think, first of all, my hat's off to you, because I saw this and I started going and looking online to see how many news channels are covering this or even talking about it. And I saw that there was none. So even that is by design. They put this out for their target being in Iran. They didn't want to make too much, maybe, noise here with it. A couple of alternative media outlets, they actually pointed out to the fact that it was released, but that was it. No analysis. You would think this would be on CNN, NBC. Oh my God, this is big, right? And then, lo and behold, I come to your site and you have written about it. So it tells me that, you know, we are on the right track with all the people that we follow. For example, I do follow your website. I'm following all your YouTube channels. It's like, yeah, I mean, other than you, I believe maybe Blacklisted and Intel News, nobody else even mentioned it. And that itself, I think, is very interesting, because you know how things happen. This, something like this comes up. If they want this to become, you know, known, it will be on every channel 24/7. They would be interviewing Shah's son, for example, getting comments from him. No. And that tells us, that tells me that the intended audience for this particular strategic release, declassification, is Middle East. Specifically, it is the Iranian audience, and it is going towards the Iranian Spring. Just watch until that Twitter stuff pop up.
I wish I could disagree with that analysis, but I can't. So let's wrap up the conversation at that point. But speaking of works that people follow, newsbud.com. Once again, congratulations. Once again, an exhortation to the people out there. Please continue. If you have not pledged yet, please do pledge. Make sure that Newsbud is comfortably over that goal, so that when it comes on Tuesday, it will 100%. The first stage will be funded. It will be completed. And when that happens, what can we expect coming out of Newsbud in the coming months?
Well, we're gonna be very busy with our production and everything. One of our producers, Spiros Gouris, moved from Seattle to Oregon to Bend. We're gonna be getting our first IMAX, so we can put our Adobe and get our Adobe. I mean, all these resources that people think, oh yeah, we have. We don't have a lot of those things. So we're gonna set up that so we can up our video productions, daily video productions. Same thing with what Peter B. Collins has been doing. Some investigative journalism work, topics that I have had on my list for a while, and those are going to be pursued. So We have been putting some samples of, you know, what we do, what kind of things we will be doing. But this is going to be like get down to, of course, it takes about 3 weeks to receive the funds from Kickstarter. So the date ends June 21st. It will be around July 10th before that fund is transferred to our organization so we can spend it and put some of these resources in place, have a little bit of travel budget. You and I are going to start talking about your documentary project. I haven't forgotten. And we love that idea. We want to support it. So we have a lot of good plans. It's just 4 days left. We want people to just maintain their vigilance. And then after that, let's celebrate all together jointly. And again, thank you for this opportunity and for this discussion session, because as we just talked about it, nobody else has been really covering it, delving into it, even though, as you can tell, the topic is big. It's really major. And I hope we will see more people challenging what they're trying to maintain here in the U.S. and start talking about it. I don't care how they want to talk about it, but pay attention and then have your antennas up. So when you see things happening, you don't assume that things are happening just out of the blue, just by themselves. No, these things lead to other things, and the other things lead to other things, all chain events and chain reactions. And this is a major element in what we're going to be seeing with Iran. So thank you for the opportunity, James.
Well, thank you for taking the time. And I should note that in the show notes for this interview, I will put not only my article on this, but also links to a couple of your Probable Cause podcasts where you talked about your own experience in the Iranian Revolution and other related materials, as well as, of course, a link to your Boiling Frogs Post YouTube channel where the recent NewsBud reports have been popping up. So if people want to take a look at what they can expect in the coming months, that would be a good place to go. We'll leave it there. Sibel Edmonds, thank you again for your time.
Thank you, James.
Now, the rest of that story. Hillary Clinton's emails make it appear the Saudi monarchy is primarily responsible for the logistical and financial support of the Islamic State. In fact, the Islamic State is not the monolithic threat it is portrayed as by the government and its media. It is a loose confederation of jihadi groups sharing a similar ideology based in Saudi Wahhabism. Many of those groups are now receiving direct financial and military support from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United States, and others. The United States is reluctant to criticize its Wahhabi partner and seriously endanger the neocon-spawned arc of crisis carefully designed to divide and balkanize the Arab and Muslim Middle East. What are you, I'm skipping to the end, but James talks about it here pretty good.
The lies by commission, the lies by taking decontextualized facts and putting them together in misleading ways, all the various ways that the MSM lies to your face each and every day. So I don't think anyone can accuse either myself or my regular audience of being surprised at the level of mendacity in the mainstream media. And yet, here I am, recording this actually on a Saturday night, absolutely blood boiling, shaking, literally shaking with anger at the lies that we see coming out of Syria right now in a what can only be described as a concerted propaganda effort to whip up war hysteria once again for another humanitarian love bombing. So, let's see if I can paint this picture for you in a orderly fashion. Let's turn to this story from Moon of Alabama that was posted up late July 2016, where it noted that CIA rebels behead kid and other U.S. successes in Syria, where it notes, among other stories, that a group of fighters under the rubric of Nur al-Din al-Zenki, moderate rebels, of course, because what other kind are there? Yesterday captured a Palestinian boy of some 8, 10, maybe 12 years, taunted him, and accused him of fighting on the Syrian government side. The boy had no uniform on and had medical infusion tubes in his right arm, but they still insisted he was a fighter. The CIA supported moderate rebels, then behead the boy with a knife right on the back of that red pickup truck. And for those who are really interested, or for those who really need proof of it, there are not only photos and videos of the child alive, but also video of the beheading itself. This boy was decapitated with a knife. Right there on video. Absolutely, unfathomably disgusting. So get a good look of these scumbags. These are the scumbags of Nur al-Din al-Zinki. They are child beheaders, who, of course, are backed by the U.S. government. As we see in this story from BBC News, which came out a couple days later, Syria conflict, boy beheaded by rebels, was a fighter. Where it notes that the sister of a boy filmed being beheaded by Syrian rebels has disputed a claim by a pro-government Palestinian militia that he was not a fighter. The Liwa al-Quds Jerusalem Brigade said Abdullah Isa was just a 12-year-old boy from a poor refugee family who lived in a rebel-held area of Aleppo. His sister later said on Facebook, well, that's journalism for you, his sister later said on Facebook that he was a Syrian from Homs who went to fight and defend his country. Members of the Nur al-Din al-Zinki movement are accused of killing him. The group said those responsible were handed over to a judicial committee and denounced the killing as a violation. The U.S., which has provided military support to the Nur al-Din al-Zinki movement in the past, said it was seeking more information on what it described as an appalling report. Here, you literally have the BBC calling these child, taking this story of this child beheading and basically justifying it. Oh, well, he was a fighter. This 12-year-old boy was a fighter. Clearly, someone who was going to do dangerous damage to these brave and valiant U.S.-supported terrorists, right? Well, of course, they were just following the State Department line on that, as usual, being good stenographers for the powers that shouldn't be. If we can prove that this was indeed what happened and this group was involved, it would give us pause about any assistance or, frankly, any further involvement with this group, State Department spokesman Mark Toner told reporters. And in case you think, oh, well, maybe this was just in the fog of war, it was only a couple of days after the incident, the State Department didn't really know the details, maybe they, once they figured everything out, they ultimately denounced Nur al-Din al-Zinki and called them out as the child-beheading scum that they are. No. This is from a press conference that was given a couple of weeks later in which they were again asked to clarify the position of the State Department. Here is State Department spokesman Mark Toner being asked, so what does a group have to do to actually be taken off the State Department list of groups or organizations that will receive State Department funding? How about beheading a child? Would that count?
It's been said that the State Department is also investigating allegations. I mean, there's a video of this group beheading a 10-year-old Palestinian boy.
Yeah,
how are those investigations going? Has there been any result?
So we did talk about that. We were looking into those that incident. Obviously, we condemned if it were true. I know that the group itself said that they had also made some arrests and then set up a commission of inquiry into the incident. I don't have any updates at this point in time, but I can certainly check and get back to you.
So what does a rebel group in Syria have to do to not receive U.S. funds any longer? What is the line that they must cross? What kind of controversial incident must take place for a group to stop receiving U.S. funds?
Well,
here, Mark, let me give you a help with this answer. The answer might go along the lines of something like, well, I can't say specifically, but maybe beheading a child might be where we draw the line. If you're a child-beheading terrorist scum, we might stop supporting you. That's the answer we're looking for here, Mark.
First of all, there's a lot of vetting of the Syrian moderate opposition that has already taken place. And it's not just by the U.S., but it's by...
Etc., blah, 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 moderate opposition. I think you see where that answer is going. Anyway, of course he doesn't say that beheading a child will actually invalidate this group from receiving any more State Department assistance. And don't take my word for it. Please do go read through the transcript of this briefing and that question and answer specifically. I'll put the link in the show notes, of course, so you can go and check it out. But yes, they are unwilling to distance themselves from this group of child beheaders. So that's just the way things roll in Syria. And here's a pretty good example of how the media has gone absolutely bending itself over backwards and into pretzel knots, trying to get you to de-link yourself from basic human morality. Oh, it's all right. They beheaded that child because he was a fighter. But wait, it gets worse. Here's a video from a few days ago from Channel 4 which had a report on inside Aleppo and talking about some of the that's strange. This video was private. It was just up maybe 24 hours ago when I checked it. Why is it gone now? I can't imagine. Oh, is it because... Let's check it out. Luckily, this was preserved here. England's Channel 4 News featuring moderate war criminals. On October 4th, 2016, England's Channel 4 News posted this video. Aleppo up close with the rebels inside the besieged Syrian city. And it's a report about, these moderate rebels and how brave and valiant they are in fighting. And they're just a bunch of farmers and factory workers who have suddenly become... You know, they were forced into this position of fighting for... Some of those faces look really familiar. What's going... Yeah, there's that guy, and... Oh, right, there's the pic... Oh. Yes, literally. Channel 4 are interviewing and lionizing the child beheaders in their report. You cannot make this up. They are literally portraying the child beheaders themselves as the moderate rebels who are fighting for freedom in Syria. Literally interviewing these people. And let me guess, I'll let you guess how many times they bring up child beheading in this video. Oh, that's right. Zero. They don't bring it up. They don't even mention, oh, by the way, these are the guys that were just busy chopping heads off of 12-year-old boys a couple of months ago. This is why it's private. This is why this is now a private video. They took it off their channel because, and I wish I could have shown this to you, but I didn't screenshot it at the time, it was massively, almost 100% thumbs down, and every single comment was calling out Channel 4 for portraying these child beheaders as valiant freedom fighters. Every single person in the comment section was denouncing Channel 4 for this. So no one was buying the propaganda this time around, but they still ran with it. They still went with it. They're now trying to distance themselves from it, apparently, but they had this report up on their YouTube channel. And this is just the way this propaganda rolls. Now, obviously, Aleppo has been one of the central parts of this whole Syria propaganda humanitarian love bombing story for a while now. So if you need to get caught up on it, you might remember, for example, Aleppo Boy and this picture that went around the world and was on the front page of every newspaper with this boy in the ambulance. Well, TruthStream Media has a good breakdown of that story and, again, how it relates to the photographer who took this picture, who was also the photographer that they showed in that picture with the headband who was taking a selfie with the child beheaders. This guy who is literally the guy who took that famous photo, literally taking selfies with the child beheaders. This story is so insane that it almost defies, it beggars description how they can just throw it in your face like that. But that's the way these stories roll. Another great source of information on what's going on in Aleppo, Christoph Gehrman at New Great Game, has this great tweet. You really should follow him on Twitter. He has great information, but this tweet alone is worth it. He breaks down what's happening in Aleppo. 2011, rebels find no support in Aleppo. The opposition couldn't get the people of Aleppo to rise up against the regime, so they sent busloads of people to Aleppo. These people would burn something on the streets and leave. Journalists would take pictures of this and broadcast it saying Aleppo has risen. So that was the phony uprising, quote-unquote, in Aleppo in 2011. 2012, the rebels invaded Aleppo. And in 2016, the rebels are actively stopping people from leaving Aleppo because they need human shields for this humanitarian love-bombing propaganda campaign. And, of course, it's all blame Assad, because it's all Assad's fault somehow that the rebels are killing people and stopping people from leaving and creating phony uprisings in cities that weren't being subject to uprising. So that's really Aleppo in a nutshell. There was no support for the rebels. The rebels invaded the town. Now the rebels are stopping people from leaving, and they blame it on Assad. If you need more information about what's happening in Syria, there was this great breakdown of the Syria ceasefire breakdown that happened just in the last few weeks, and what that means and how it came about. Syrian Girl doing a great overview video here that's really must watch if you're new to all of this information. If you're seeing the propaganda that's spewing out about the white helmets, the valiant white helmets in Syria, who are up for a Nobel Peace Prize and need to understand what's really behind that. This episode of Crosstalk breaks that down for you. You have Patrick Henningsen and Vanessa Beely and Eva Bartlett on talking about the propaganda going on about the white helmets and how they are not what they are being portrayed to be. And the idea of giving them a peace prize is only appropriate if it puts them in the category of war criminals like Kissinger and Obama. But just to keep in mind what's really behind this and what the stakes really are, of course, we have Soros blasting Putin for Russian actions in Syria, which is pretty much the story of this propaganda campaign in a nutshell. It's people like Soros making sure to put Putin in the crosshairs for what's happening in Syria and avoiding any mention of anything that the U.S. is doing, like, oh, I don't know, supporting child beheaders. And again, it gets even more blatant. Russia warns U.S. airstrikes on Syrian army would lead to war. Air defenses are active. Or in even a more blunt headline from Blacklisted News, Russia threatens to shoot down U.S. jets. And yes, that's exactly what is happening. In a stark warning to the U.S., a spokesman for the Russian Defense Ministry said Russia may shoot down U.S. planes attempting to launch airstrikes in Syria. I would recommend our colleagues in Washington to thoroughly consider the possible consequences of the realization of such plans, which is diplomatic speak for you guys are going to start a war. And Russia has deployed advanced S-300 and S-400 anti-aircraft missiles to its bases in Syria, so it is not an idle threat. And, well, if you need to hear it from someone else, you can get it from Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, who told the Armed Services Committee recently this uncomfortable piece of information.
The president.
What about the option of controlling the airspace so that barrel bombs cannot be dropped?
Well, all the options.
What do you think of that option, sir?
Right now, Senator, for us to control all of the airspace in Syria would require us to go to war against Syria and Russia.
Yeah. I think that wasn't the answer they were looking for there, was it, Mr. Wicker? Absolutely. Outrageous. We are being strung along by crude propaganda, literally promoting and lionizing child beheading terrorists as freedom fighters. If this sounds familiar, it's because this is the exact same script that has been playing out for decades now, and we can go back at least to the Taliban and the Afghan war and all of that nonsense that happened in the 80s. So history repeats, and the first time as tragedy, the second time as farce. Well, I don't know what we can even call this, as this is probably the 100th iteration of this piece of history, and it looks like it's only getting more nightmarish by the day. If there is any bright spot in this, it is that, as I say, this YouTube video, which now has been yanked, really was flooded with comments of people absolutely disgusted with Channel 4 for promoting those child beheaders, as they should be, and showing that no one, literally no one in the comment section was buying the propaganda. And Off Guardian, which focuses on the Guardian's propaganda, always doing a great job at showing some of the redacted reality that the Guardian tries to hide from its readership, talking about a recent editorial that was part of this White Helmets Should Get the Nobel Peace Prize pitch, where only 7 people actually supported the Guardian's fact-free editorial. And it says, the Guardian's comments are the now standard disaster zone, open for less than an hour, and with a full one-third, that's 18 of the 55 comments, censored. Of the 37 remaining, only 15 support the Guardian's position, and those 15 comments are all made by the same 7 people. This is less about propaganda and more about cultist reality denial. Again, I'll throw the link into this and every single one of these articles and videos in the show notes so that you can go and read through that for yourself. But suffice it to say, the humanitarian love bombing propaganda is ramping up. We have seen this script before, and we know where it leads. And I want the liars in the mainstream media who are literally venerating the child beheading terrorists as part of this propaganda campaign to know that the blood of all of the innocent civilians who could and would be slaughtered in any such full-scale invasion and full-scale military conflict with Russia, all of that blood is on the hands of the mainstream media liars who are propagating these lies. That is not something to take lightly, and I hope that these people who are propagating these lies know what that really means. Please get this information out to everyone that you know who is still trapped in the mainstream media vortex of lies. There are far too many people who know nothing, nothing whatsoever outside what the boob tube, the tell lie vision tells them each and every day, and we have to confront that.
First year, and they kept me for 2 years, so I was basically recovered from that physical ordeal. And mentally, I don't think they ever really got to me. So, I was delighted to have some friends to go gallivanting around the globe with and, you know, like be in a movie. Sounds like a good idea to me.
Okay, so, Theo, I have to say your personality, your character, in a way makes this film not depressing. When I started watching it, I thought, all right, here, I'd steel myself. This is going to be a heavy film about this guy being tortured. And throughout the film, you share the horrific things that were done to you in a way that I don't think many people might be able to deal with. And maybe that's just your personality. But I have to say, you know, kudos to you for being so sort of straightforward about it. David, let me ask you what led you to making this documentary. Did you meet Theo and say this guy's story needs to be told?
Basically, Theo had known my wife when they were younger, and I had followed his case as someone who had also reported in the Middle East and felt, you know, there but for the grace of God went I.
They brought me into a room like this. Three of them sat down. They said, why don't you do an interview with this guy here? One guy kicked me right really hard in the face. And they're all stamping on me and kicking on me. Put on the handcuffs. They cuffed me behind my back like this. And they said, we're our prisoner now. Out there is the sun. This is the last time you'll see the sun. Do you understand? I said, yes. And then they ordered takeaway chicken and brought it in and had lunch.
I called the FBI and I said, my son's missing in Syria. And the guy said, that's a dangerous place. I didn't ask him to go there. What do you expect me to do?
They brought me down to the room of death. The two kids are on either side of me. One of them whispered, goes, we kill you. We kill you now.
Allahu Akbar.
This place was clearly under attack. And there'd be people down the hall being tortured. I was 200 days in this cell. I had to sleep diagonally like this. The guards, I was dependent on them for the air that I breathed. They're just young men. There's tons of food and guns and people to torture. I mean, most of them are having fun. There's a lot of fun in the jihad. It's very underrated in the West. Some of the guards stopped coming to my jail cell. I would ask, and they'd say, he's been martyred. Who killed him? Oh, Islamic State. I was interested in the grievances. It was balm for hurt minds. It soothed the poison out of them. It calmed them down. Yeah, and try to remind yourself, I'm still alive. I'm still alive. I rescued something from the disaster of 2 years. And it was this story.
Theo, Who Lived, opens nationwide this month. You can find out more about the film at the website theowholived.com. And the film's protagonist, if you will, is with us right now, Theo Padnos, an American journalist. He survived, as you just saw in the trailer, 22 months in captivity in Syria. The film's director, David Chisgall, is also with me. Theo, how important was it to tell the story of your mother on the other side of the planet in Vermont as she struggled to figure out what had happened to you and try to find a way to get you freed?
How important was it for her or for me?
How important was it to have that as part of the story for the audience to see that kidnappings like this don't just impact the person being kidnapped, but people who who love you?
I think it was mostly the director's decision to include
in Brooklyn.
Translated it from Arabic into English, and I put it in my book. I didn't want it to be like a really complicated sort of thing with the Shia and the Sunni, and because in fact it's just human beings acting with one another according to motivations that anybody can understand. So I felt that I didn't need to I could make it accessible to a Western reader by setting the entire drama in Vermont and having characters from my mom's hometown that she understands, like, you know, Hippie Jim. And, you know, I took the characters that she knows and the places that she knows, and I put the drama that I knew in that town. And that's what my book is about.
Well, I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the film. It's opened this month in theaters around the country. And the website is theowholived.com. Theo Padnos, David Chisgall, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having
me. Is to bring you beyond life and to make you give up on life. And if they don't kill you, they bring you back, but in their own image, you know, as one of them. So I think they're trying to make you kind of die to your old self and to be reborn among them. And they did that, you know, they kept me in that state of death for, you know, probably longer than a year. And when I did come back to life, I was delighted to be alive, but I'm also, you know, they could have killed me. So in a way, grateful to them, but I'm not like, I don't think I'm that Stockholm syndrome-y, oh yes, I love you. No, I realize they're evil people. However, they could have killed me and they didn't, and they gave me some life, so I'm grateful.
Hmm. And you spent 7 months at one point in that first year in captivity with another journalist, Matthew Schreier, and that wasn't a very pleasant experience for you, as one might imagine it might have been, to, you know, have some company, especially fellow American. And you describe in the film how you helped Schreier escape, and he didn't help you. I thought this was a really interesting part of the film. Have you had the chance to meet with Mr. Schreier since you've been back in the U.S.?
I think he wanted to, but I'm not interested. He was like abusive relationship sort of person. It's like being in an abusive relationship, and he was always hitting me.
Was it just a trauma that he was basically taking out on you? Or?
I don't know why he was inflicting this pain and suffering on me, but I often told him, like, you are torturing me now. What are you doing? You're doing to me what they're doing to us. Why? I mean,
he endangered you when he told his story after returning to the U.S. and the media inadvertently revealed your name.
Not inadvertently. No, they deliberately printed my name. They thought it was a dramatic story, and mm-hmm. so they did. But, I mean, look, all of that is water under the bridge. I'm not angry, it's not even a major issue for me at the moment, because there's so many people in Syria that are suffering so much today, and I want this suffering to end, you know, now. So it is certainly a part of the film, a part of my experience, and I'm happy to talk about it, but I'm not dwelling on it in my personal thoughts and memories, because I'm focused just now on other things. Like, I wouldn't want to call up this guy or get in relationship or discuss the past or who did what to whom.
And David, in the process of making this film, you said that you built some sets, and there's this one part of the film where Theo spent 200 days, that's more than 6 months, in this incredibly tiny cell. And in the film, this looks like you've built a set. Can you tell us about this part of the film where, you know, Theo literally...
Once again, all of the links to all of these stories and videos will be in the show notes for this video. Please get this information out to others, and please start following people like Christoph Gehrman and...
Helmet, death squad, cheerleaders in the media and all that. Like James Corbett was shaking mad, I just go out and stand in their way at the U.S. Naval Weapons Station in north of Concord. The tracks have been incorporated into the city of Concord, so, like, I have recently been hauled off to Concord, but usually they go off to Martinez Detention Facility or... Anyway, you will probably find me soon at 5300 Port Chicago Highway.
And he really needs to be acknowledged as well.
Yeah. Well, depending on what you count, in 2009 I stopped going out there, but you got it right on page 241 of Blood on the Tracks, where Jim Wilcott's also mentioned. But my little question had to do with the order of permanent injunction that stops torture. It's a permanent injunction. Stanley Weigel gave it to Nuremberg Actions, and anybody going out there, if you are following the nonviolent protocols, there is a standing federal court order to prohibit torture. Unique in the country, perhaps, but I'm sure you're aware of that. I just like to point it out, and also take the opportunity to quibble with your statement. You guess you were trying to get out of the way because there were only three options in that letter you sent to the Navy: that they would not run the train, that they would drag you out of the way, or they'd run it over your dead body.
Right.
And you don't remember what happened, so how can you say what you were doing? Because we had a rule. We are not going to block if we think we'll jump out of the way. And you yourselves, I think with Holly, planned to dive under the train. But I
don't know what?
Well, I believe I recall a conversation, maybe not with you, but I think Holly mentioned that you and she had discussed diving under the train rather than jumping out of the way if it came down to it. But my little synthesis of tonight, and I'm sorry to be critical, you pay the price for peace when you say, okay, it was an accident. It wasn't an accident. They did it on purpose. Well, you said you were trying to get out of the way.
Well, I do believe from looking at the photographs that my autonomic nervous system was actually trying to get out of the way, even though my intention was not to leave. And you might note that Duncan Murphy, he jumped straight up and grabbed the railing over the cow catcher. He did not leave the tracks.
It would have chopped you in two if you had tried to get out of the way.
Pardon me?
The train would have cut you in two if you had tried to get out of the way. The only possibility is that you followed your intent to dive under it, and that's what saved you.
I don't know. I have no idea what I did. I don't remember.
But the court would not reward you saying that I had a right to stand my ground and you ran me down in cold blood. See, that is not the acceptable story that it will allow you to get the peace that you're enjoying in your life. And I don't want to jeopardize that in any way. We're all entitled to that kind of peace. But for those of us that are going to be going out there under Hellbat Clinton, just remember, as long as you're nonviolent, they cannot torture you. And it's not possible for me to be nonviolent without, in the back of my mind, the first impulse from the horrible ladies when I sued William Casey because of that alternative. And that is what makes it possible for me to pray not to get out of the way, even over my dead body. And to tell the cop it was a good day to die on Hiroshima Day, that is on Greg from Tracks at YouTube. You can see my false arrest, and I beat him in federal court. But that's enough about me. And a quibbling about, another thing you said in your book, Operation North Woods hadn't been tried, but that's what the 9/11 is, of course. And that's what the Kennedy assassination was. And that's what they were doing when they phoned in the threat on behalf of the veteran staffing. It's the inside job. You point the provocateur in the thing, and then you order the crew not to stop because those are terrorists. Okay.
Is Michael Kroll still here? Michael Kroll? Michael Kroll was a witness at September 1st. He was actually holding the Nuremberg Actions banner behind us. You can actually see him in the video if you were looking. He was on the right side of the banner, or on the left side of the banner as you were looking at the banner from the train. But do you have any comments, Michael? Because you were an eyewitness.
Under the train as it was about to
crime